This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello and welcome along to the latest All Football Commentators Are Geeks podcast with me, Michelle Owen from Sky Sports and Soccer Saturday.
Sam Matterface from TalkSport and ITV Sport.
Alex Crook from TalkSport and everyone's favourite tabloid news hound.
And I'm Ed Chamberlain from ITV Racing.
Sam and Alex get an away day as they take Ed for lunch to get him talking about switching Carragher, Neville and Sky for the Grand National, Francesca Cumani and AP McCoy at ITV. Plus, we will have the story of the latest weekend in numbers and stat or spin.
Crook will explain why Watford's Nathaniel Shalabar had a late fitness test thanks to an over-enthusiastic bus driver.
And after a calamitous weekend of officiating, we will tell you why video technology was not ready to come into the Premier League this year.
All that on the podcast that's sweeping the nation like Trigger's famous broom in Only Fools and Horses. All football commentators are geeks.
The podcast that thinks a treat is stopping at Beaconsfield Services. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Right, Sam and Alex are having an away day, which they haven't invited me on. Where are you boys?
We're in a hotel in Winchester. It's not some romantic break. We're just down the road from a pub in which we visited Ed Chamberlain. You're going to hear that interview a little bit later on. So we're in a hotel at the moment using free Wi-Fi. So if you hear a coffee machine going off in the background, basically that's our payoff for being able to use the facilities here at the Holiday Inn in Winchester. It's quite nice, although we are very close, aren't we?
Yeah, it's like when you get on a train and there's a seat next to you and you think, I've got plenty of leg room here. And then the fattest bloke comes and sits next to you. That's how Sam feels right now, I would imagine.
Correct.
Oh, how romantic. And looking forward to hearing that chat with Ed in just a while. And I'd just like to put a disclaimer for me. You two are in very close bodily contact, but you won't want to be near me. I sound like this week because I am full of cold, thanks to all the cold gantries.
I'm pleased you're miles
sorry
away.
For sounding. Who do I sound like?
Demi Moore.
Demi Moore, right, no. Right, let's just move on. Right, the big game of the weekend was always going to be at Old Trafford, but there were plenty of talking points up and down the country. So here is the story of another Premier League game week in numbers.
Manchester City hardly had to get out of first gear to sweep arch-rivals United aside 3-1 on Sunday. Their match-clinching third goal featured 44 passes, the most since one matter scored for United against Southampton more than 3 years ago.
Yeah, I was in the Sky Sports News studio watching that as it happened. It really was a thing of beauty. Maurizio Sarri became the first manager in Premier League history to avoid defeat in each of his first 12 games in charge. The last time Chelsea did that, in 2014, they went on to win the title.
Yeah, they definitely won't win it this year, though. At the opposite end of the table, it looks bleak for Fulham, doesn't it? After losing 2-0 at Liverpool, albeit in controversial circumstances, the Cottagers have now conceded 31 goals from their opening 12 Premier League games. Only Barnsley in 97-98 have let in more goals at this stage of the season with 35. They went down.
That's damning.
Yeah, really, really surprised at Fulham. Alex, you were at the game between Southampton and Watford when the ref, Simon Hooper, upset both sides with controversial decisions. It sparked one of the rants from Charlie Austin. It was quite a rant, and it was also an afternoon to forget for Nathaniel Shalabar, wasn't it?
Yeah, it certainly was. First of all, how refreshing was it to hear a player speak like Charlie Austin did? It was like he'd just come off the pitch on a Sunday morning, having had 15 pints the night before. But it was just a wonderful rant. In this day where players are so media trained and they're told what to say, just to let rip from the heart. He did conveniently forget the fact that Watford should have had a penalty themselves. And of course, the man involved in that penalty was Nathaniel Shalabar. He was definitely fouled by Ryan Bertrand, but it wasn't his afternoon, because after the game, I was just leaving through the players' entrance, and he was in discussion with Nathan Redmond, I think they're teammates for the England under-21s in the past, when he spotted out the corner of his eye the Watford coach driving off down the road without him. That prompted a frantic scene where Nathaniel Shalabar had to move at pace onto the street outside St Mary's, chase after the coach and then flag it down to make sure that he didn't get left behind.
It is a great story, and you can see it in your mind's eye, him chasing after. It's like he's got a good turn of pace, isn't it? You mentioned also about Charlie Austin's rant, and this is really unprofessional, but hasn't he got a very odd voice? He doesn't sound like you would expect him to sound. And when he opens his mouth, that voice doesn't fit that face, does it?
Have you
Yeah, but he was worked up. Because when you're worked up, your voice goes higher, okay?
Have you seen the video, though, where they've actually dubbed his rant over the music to Park Life? Yeah. It is fantastic. Yeah,
so very, very good indeed. Good. I was at Crystal Palace at the weekend watching the Tottenham game. It wasn't a particularly good game. It was wet, it was wild, it was soaking, it was depressing. And also, even more depressing than the fact that Crystal Palace haven't won at home for 6 months, let's be honest, this is a place that isn't fit for Premier League football. And in terms of Premier League venues, this is a place that is back in the last century. There's iron girders everywhere. You can hardly see the pitch from the press box because there's so many obstacles between the back of the stand and the pitch itself. It's really poor. And if you look at the facilities that are underneath, I mean, some of the facilities have been upgraded over the course of the last few years, but underneath the main stand where the players congregate, it was described to me by one official as the worst player area in the country. There's old rooms that have been converted into modern use. It means that it's tighter down there in this little rabbit warren than Crook's trousers. I mean, it's just like everyone jostling in and out of little interview cupboards. It's not comfortable for players. It's not comfortable for managers. And I think actually that maybe contributed to Roy's mood after the game when he got a little bit irate about the fact that when he went to go into the match of the day interview room, Maurizio Pochettino was already in there. And he went, well, I'm ready now. Oh, well, I'll just send Ray in. And he got a bit irate about it. In the end, he was coaxed into doing the interview. So he got a little bit fiery about that. And then he got even more fiery when someone suggested to him that they had an over-reliance on Wilfried Zaha. He said it wasn't true until someone pointed out that in the last 13 games they've played without Wilfried Zaha, they've lost. Not failed to win, they've lost all 13.
I'd imagine a Hodgson rant like that is a bit like when you wake up your granddad on Christmas Day when he's fallen asleep after a bit too much turkey and he gets the right amp, doesn't he?
He is going to be the oldest ever Premier League manager at some point this season. And look, you know, that's got nothing to do with it. I don't want to be ageist here. But the fact is he is quite grisly at the moment. But then again, if I hadn't won for 181 days at Selhurst Park and I was the manager of Crystal Palace, I'd be pretty grumpy too.
You know, you said about the underground of it being very cramped, and I've seen the views from the press. Is it still a really good atmosphere there when they haven't won there for so long? So I've got friends that are Palace fans and they usually rave about the atmosphere. So is that still there or is that sort of ebbing away now?
I think there was an issue with the ultras, wasn't there, earlier in the season where they were a bit upset about where they were being moved to or ushered to. The atmosphere certainly wasn't as good as it was last season or the season before when they were winning a lot of games. And you know, the early part of the season before, I think under Alan Pardew, they had a good start. I think the end of last season, they had a good finish under Roy Hodgson, or a certain point of the season, they did very well under him. They've won some big games there in the past few years, and it doesn't feel like that. But it was a reasonable atmosphere. I mean, you know, the weather was awful. It really was absolutely disgusting to be out in it on Saturday night. So, I mean, and that probably dampened people's enthusiasm.
Yeah, it was horrible. I remember having to time my run. I'm very lucky when I go to Bristol City, where I was this weekend, covering a dire game between them and Preston. It's not far to totter from my car into the press area, but it was torrential downpours. And afterwards, it was honestly the worst game I have watched this season. Really bad.
What was bad about it?
And then I spent almost just no chances. Just one of those games where nothing is created. Preston had a couple. They nicked one early on. And then afterwards, Alex Neil said it was the complete away performance. Take nothing away from them. They managed the game really well. They were really organised. But to watch as a neutral, so boring. Bristol City, I think, took until the 80th minute to have a shot on target. And even then, that was a free kick. Really, really poor game. And somewhere I go, obviously, quite a lot. And now the fans are getting a little bit impatient. There was boos at half time. There were boos at full time. They booed their own striker off when he was substituted. So it's just turning down there a little bit at the moment. But you know, they're solid mid-table, Bristol City, just on a side note. And for where they are financially and in terms of other things, that's where you'd expect them to be. But afterwards, I had to get back to the dog. I had to get back to Barney, which, you know, is very important.
Oh yes,
Nigel Clough. He takes his dog.
That's the most important thing you have to do on a Saturday night, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, the husband was out, so I had to get back. And I waited almost an hour to do post-match. I think it was... I walked out of Ashton Gate. The game probably finished 10:45. I got in my car at 5:06.
Poor Barney.
Yeah, poor Barney. I was like, he needs his treats. How long do I wait for?
Was it worth the wait, though? That's the big question. Was Lee Johnson great value after you'd spoke to him?
This is what you hope for, isn't it? I know I will... not name them, but I have a friend who works as a reporter that once had to catch a train and they waited so long for Chris Wilder that they just binned the interview and legged it. Was he good value? He was all right. But, you know, was it worth waiting an hour for? I'm not sure.
Does he have to stand on a box when you interview him? He's quite short, isn't he, Lee Johnson?
Not for Michelle.
Yeah, he's about... I mean, for me, Crook, you've got to remember how short I am. He's about my height, so
I once had to wait an hour and a half for Thierry Henry. It was when he'd come back to Arsenal on loan and scored the goal against Leeds United. I had to wait an hour and a half for him. But when he came out, two things. He smelt magnificent. I mean, like he'd just been oiled in cocoa butter with the most expensive Creed scent you've ever had. Going up your nose. And he was magnificent value. He was brilliant. And he stood there and he talked for 15 minutes. And I didn't care about the fact that I had to get an expensive cab ride. I got a cracking interview and he was absolutely superb.
Sol Campbell used to be a nightmare when he was at Portsmouth. He wouldn't come out and do his media interviews until he'd had a two-hour massage, which was highly annoying. I think he also annoyed his teammates because even though he was club captain, he wouldn't let anybody... no matter if it was a player, coaching staff, whatever, sit next to him on the plane on away journeys. He had to have his own two-seated row.
Yeah, I can understand why I'd want that, having to sit next to you today.
But apparently, Sean Dyche, someone told me that when they've done interviews with him, they had to wait, like, not long, like 20 minutes. They came out and, like, unreservedly apologised. How nice is that, that some managers and players do that? I've not come across them yet, but I think that's
you'll find
classy.
Them one day, Michelle.
I'm still looking. You are listening to the All Football Commentators of Geeks podcast. And remember, you can follow on Instagram or get in touch with us via Twitter. The handles are the same, at AFC Geeks. Send us your questions and we will answer as many of them as we can in the next episode.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks or get in touch on Instagram.
Okay, time for another round of Stat or Spin, where we each come up with an interesting fact from the weekend just gone. And the other two of us have to guess if it's entirely accurate or partly exaggerated.
Lift off and the clock has started.
Sam, what have you got for us?
This is for you, Crook. This is a special one for you. Because it's a new low, this, for Jose Mourinho, isn't it?
Here we go.
We already know that they've made their worst start, Manchester United, since 1990. But this is the stat I want you to tell me whether or not it is stat or spin. Manchester United lost the first half of Sunday's Manchester derby 1-0. They lost the second half 2-1. It's the first time that they've lost both halves of a game in 123 matches. Is that stat or spin?
I had the misfortune of being there when they went down to Manchester City 6-1 at Old Trafford. It's the only time I've left Old Trafford early. They were 4-1 down, and by the time I got to the pub at the end of the road, they were 6-1 down.
You didn't go to the pub. You came back up into the press box to see me.
No, I went via the pub, first of all, and then came back to see you. So were they losing that game at half-time? They must have been losing that game
at
half-time.
Was that 123 games ago? Think about how many games that is.
It was the same year. Because I went the first week, we beat Arsenal 8-3, and then went back the following week, and we lost 6-1. Okay, I'm going to say stat then.
Okay. And what about you, Michelle?
Before this weekend, I think they'd won each of their last three games 2-1. But going further back than that, I'm not a Man United geek like Crook is. But I think it's spin.
It is a stat. Ooh. That's how bad things have got, Crook.
Dear.
What a great debate between Graeme Souness and Gary Neville after the game. I was watching it with the wife, actually, and she said, look, Souness looks fuming. Like, every time Gary Neville said anything, he was rolling his eyes, shaking his head. He looked like he was going to punch him.
It looks like that most weeks. Michelle, what have you got for us?
Yep. My stat is about Huddersfield, who have not had a great time of late, but they have picked up 4 points in the last week. Drew with West Ham on Saturday, and before that, they picked up their first win of the season on the Monday Night Football, beating Fulham 1-0. And by doing that, they became the last side in English football to win a league game this season. Is that stat or spin? In the whole of English football.
Stat. Yeah, I'm going stat. Cardiff. Yep. Stat. I'm going stat.
I'm going to say about spin because I think Macclesfield in League Two may not have won a game.
Did they not win that game where there was two teams, them and somebody else, where they had a they hadn't won a game between them in 68 or something? I can't remember.
I'm going to say spin.
Okay, I'm going to go stat. What is it?
It is a stat. On Monday, they became the last side in English football to win a league game this season. And Macclesfield actually did win on the 20th of October when they beat Carlisle 2-1.
Yes, that's the one I was talking about. What have you got?
Well, I'm just about to write a story. Shane Long out for 6 weeks. He's got some kind of ankle problem, needs an operation. Now, normally you'd think in Southampton's position, when one of their main strikers is ruled out, that's a significant blow. Maybe not in Shane Long's case, because he's only scored twice in 61 games for Southampton.
I think that's spin.
It's once. I'm sure it's once in 61 games.
I think it's spin because it's something to do with 63 games, isn't it now? Isn't it 63 or something like that now?
I thought it was once, but you could be right, Sam, but I'm pretty sure that's spin in some little way.
Yeah.
It's actually two goals in 56 games for Southampton, two in 63 for Southampton and the Republic of Ireland. That is dreadful, isn't it?
So I got it right for the club and country, right? Just off the top of my head there. Did you hear that?
Yeah, impressive.
Unbelievable.
Okay, if you like the podcast, make sure you rate and review it on iTunes and subscribe via your podcast supplier. Next up, Sam and Alex will be chatting to ITV Racing Supremo and the former face of Sky's Monday Night Football, Ed Chamberlain.
Now, we're sitting here in the beautiful autumnal sunshine in a glorious little pub in Hampshire, in Winchester. And I'm delighted to say that lunching here with Alex and I is Ed Chamberlain. How are you? All right?
I'm great. I brought you to the place where Sammy Lee used to live when he was coaching Southampton. And I think Ronald Koeman quite enjoyed coming here as well.
Perfect place. Sammy Lee is one of those rare people that have managed to coach Everton, Brave Liverpool, England, Southampton. Well, if you can get him back to Portsmouth, then he's got the full set.
He's a top man, top man.
The last time I saw you, we were in the Royal Festival Hall, and I think we were dancing, and Gemma Collins from Towie was watching from a balcony. And half of loose women were there as well.
And Love Island. I remember it.
But that might be for a different podcast. But how's the racing going?
Sam, it's going really well, really well. We're coming to the end of our second year of broadcasting the racing on ITV, and I even got asked here in the car park, you know, why did you leave Sky to go to racing? Why did you leave football to go to racing? It's a question I get asked a lot, but it's a question and a decision I have no second thoughts about ever, really.
So, tell us, why did you jilt Carragher and Neville?
Well, I didn't jilt Neville, because Neville had gone to Valencia at the time, which obviously went extremely well, so I didn't leave Sky because I wasn't enjoying it at all. I love working with Cara, I love working with Nev, I love the Monday Night Football and Super Sunday team, and how lucky was I to do that job. But I'd been at Sky 17 years, I'd done Super Sunday and Monday Night Football for six, and I was sort of interested in doing something else. I wanted another challenge. Racing's always something I've been passionate about. I've always been passionate about football as well, but I never thought it would come along. And then when ITV came to me, I just thought, fancy a crack at that.
The way that ITV do their racing coverage is obviously very different to the way that Channel 4, who had the rights for many years, used to. You seem to be trying to appeal to the wider public. Was that a big part of your remit when you came in? How much have you been able to use your own ideas to make it more accessible?
I think that's exactly what we had to do. Listen, Channel 4 had done it for a long time, 30 years, and done a magnificent job. An absolutely magnificent job. But we did need to be different. We needed to take it in a different direction. We needed to broaden the audience. And that's our biggest challenge. And I knew that from day one, because, you know, I love watching my racing. I was an absolute, you know, Channel 4 addict in many ways. That was my escape from football, and what Claire Balding did and Nick Luck did was terrific. So it was a daunting job to go into, but a big challenge, because in racing, you've got to keep people happy at either end of the spectrum. You're racing aficionados like yourself, and you've got to attract new people to a very complex sport. And you've got to get that balance right to keep as many people happy as you can. And as I know well, you can't keep everyone happy, but in our 2 years, it's gone really well, and figures are fantastic and growing, which is very unusual, as you two will know, in this industry at the moment. And ITV4 is flourishing, and we took a lot of stick for putting some racing on ITV4, but that couldn't have gone better. To win a BAFTA was lovely, I'll admit that. And we've got a long way to go. Long, long way to go. You know, we're 2 years in. Hopefully that's a very small amount of time and what's going to be a long journey for me and ITV with the horse racing.
Do you keep that BAFTA in a special place or does Paul McNamara have it?
Do you know what, Sam? I don't get one. As the presenter, you don't get one. And I'm appealing to BAFTA because when people come round for dinner, a lot of people know, obviously, and they'll say, can we see it? And I'm like, I ain't got
Here's
one.
A picture.
I ain't got one. Alice Plunk is actually trying to get little replicas to put on our mantelpieces, which would be nice. Yeah, Macca's got his. When I went, he moved. He's my director, and yours sometimes. And when he moved house, I went to have lunch with him a few days after he moved in, and guess what had been unpacked?
Yeah, that was already out. I can imagine. How important do you think it is in a world where we're downloading, we're watching on demand, we're using satellite television, there's a lot more, there's a proliferation of channels. How important is it and why is it important that sport remains on terrestrial TV?
It's a great question. And I made a big speech the other day, which got a few column inches, that racing doesn't know how lucky it is. And I stand by that because I think racing would be the envy of so many other sports in that it's had terrestrial television coverage and continues to do so. And I think that's vital for live sport for one, and I think it's vital for the sport of horse racing for two. But I think every sport needs it and would love it. Look at cricket. Cricket's a sport that's gone full circle now. When the latest round of rights came up, was desperate to get back on terrestrial television. And what Sky and others have done with sports is sensational. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying for some sports, terrestrial television is so important with racing, with its advertising and the people it needs to reach. Show jumping would be the best comparison for it. When I grew up, I remember show jumping being the type of sport you'd appointment to watch TV with your family. You'd watch the Hickstead Derby. I can remember when I was young, I remember Eddie Macken winning on a horse called Boomerang. I had no interest in show jumping whatsoever, but it was the thing you did. Show jumping left.
I used to watch Kabaddi on Channel 4. That's a true story.
There you go. Where is it now? And show jumping would be the one I would use as an example to racing. Just to be careful, because you lose your terrestrial television coverage and where do you go from there? I couldn't name you anything about show jumping right now, personally. And I love my horses and that shows you. That's just my warning. That's what I think.
One of the downsides, perhaps, of making racing more accessible and more popular is some of the scenes that we've seen, scenes of trouble that normally you would associate perhaps with football and not racing, particularly at Goodwood and Ascot last year. What can the authorities do to change that?
I think what the authorities did was excellent. I think the most important thing was to get on the front foot immediately. These were isolated incidents. When you think how many race meetings there are, and this was a couple of incidents in early summer, when there weren't football fixtures, I think, on that day. Something like that. I say
blame us.
And what they did, they got on the front foot. And I think I played quite a big role in that because I was immediately able to say, and we showed, I said to my producer and director, I want to see sniffer dogs and I want to see police presence because I want to be able to say on ITV, anyone thinking of coming here to cause trouble, forget it. This isn't the place to do it because racing had got on the front foot and battled it and they did it, touch wood, very successfully. We didn't have a spot of bother after that. And racing's not alone. You know, there will always be these problems. It's society at the moment, isn't it? Racing's had problems in the past. It had a couple of problems last summer, but hopefully they were isolated incidents that I think they tackled extremely well. And let's hope it doesn't happen again. And I think it's very important, the role I could play and the role ITV could play is to show that measures were being taken and they were being proactive, which was good, very good.
You've had your own battles to fight as well. I think when we were working together, you were off work for 6 or 7 months with stomach cancer. It was quite a harrowing time for you and your family. Did that influence your decision about your career and your career path, the fact that you were going to embrace every moment, for example? Because it was an awful time.
It was. And listen, I'm very lucky. I know, sitting here now and thinking it was only just down the road at Southampton Hospital, they saved my life. And for a while, it looked very bleak. And it was 9 months I was off. And I'd hoped at the time it was going to be 6. And then my stomach operation went wrong and it was an extra 3, which was heartbreaking at the time. But I was lucky. I was really, really lucky compared to what most people go through. And it's had a huge influence on me. Huge influence on me. In that, yeah, I am prepared to take a risk, and that would have played a part without a shadow of a doubt in my decision to leave Sky and go to ITV. I was much more, as you remember, I was very conservative before then, and yeah, it would have definitely played a part. And there's not a day goes by when you don't think about it, and there's not a big event. I'll be at Cheltenham on Saturday, and you know, the sun might be shining in the morning. I'll just have a little moment to myself thinking, crikey, I remember where I was. But it was a very difficult time. And I'm so thankful to those heroes and heroines of nurses who helped save me and continue to help save others. And I took a lot out of it, and that's why one of the things I'm passionate about now, it broke my heart seeing children in hospital going through similar to me and being in hospital, which is why my charity Wellchild gets people out of hospital, gets kids out of hospital and treated at home. That's the sort of the real legacy, I think, of what I went through. But I don't feel unfortunate. It wasn't nice at the time. Much harder for my family than for me to go through that. And gosh, you know, to come out the other end. And there's a jockey at the moment going through, not dissimilar, in Pat Smullen. And God, he's tackled it well. It's tough, but you've got to be mentally very strong. And there's no one stronger mentally than Pat. And when we see him back riding, that's going to be a very emotive moment.
Did you have to be mentally strong as well when the Monday Night Football gig came your way? Because, of course, you inherit it really because of what happened with Richard Keys and Andy Gray. How difficult was that for you to take the job under those circumstances? And big shoes to fill as well. They've been the voice of the Premier League and Sky's coverage for two decades.
Yeah, that's right, 20 years. It was daunting. I'd come from nowhere. I was the 14-1 outsider to get the job. And I was thrown right in at the deep end. And it was really daunting, actually. They were big shoes to fill. I had to have thick skin overnight, because I remember the first Monday Night Football I ever did with Gary Neville, Man City Swansea, made an absolute horlicks of it, and we trended globally on Twitter for all the wrong reasons. I had family members crying when they were reading what they were reading about me, and you've got to learn to take it, which is why when ITV Racing started, we took a lot of stick on day one. You know, in the Times I was described as being about as exciting as a self-assembly chest of drawers from IKEA. Some would say it's probably a bit harsh on the self-assembly chest of drawers from IKEA. But
sometimes putting those together can be quite exciting.
And, you know, little examples. And I remember ringing Gary Neville, and Nev would always say, "It's never as bad as you think, Ed." And he said, "Think how what it was like for me when I got given 3 out of 10 after my England debut in the papers, and when he was in the Premier League ugly 11 at right back. When the little caption underneath said, with a face only his mother could love."
He wouldn't be there now, though. He's worked quite hard, hasn't he, now?
On his appearance.
Yeah.
Yes. I nicked some of his clothes, but he went to Valencia. I thought, right, he's not coming back. I went in his locker and nicked a few of his tie. He's got some nice gear.
He always wears nice gear. He prides himself in the way he looks now.
His hair. I think he drove everyone mad at ITV. You get Nev ready to go on air, and then he'll always scruff up his hair about 10 seconds before you go on air, and you can see the stylist going, "Oh, no, what are you doing?"
It was good to have him on ITV in the summer. You mentioned that... He's brilliant to work with. There was a lot of innovation that came in after you took over Monday Night Football. Who was responsible for that? How much input did you have in it?
I'd love to say me, Sam, but it wasn't me at all, really. I had my hands full, as we've just discussed with Alex there, with looking after my job. It was a great team. Great team. Scott Melvin was my producer then. Andy Melvin was his dad. He was a big part of what had gone on before. And Scott hopefully won't listen to this, because he's got a bit of genius about him, Scott. And Duncan East was the director, played a big part. And Jack Hazard, who's now in charge, has got Scott's job, was part of that team as well. And along with Karen, Nev, that was the engine room. We've still got our WhatsApp group now, because we were always in touch with ideas and things to do. And God, I loved it. It was such good fun. And everyone played their part. But producer and director were the real driving force and the innovators, though I'm sure Nev, Karen and I will probably claim credit along the line, but I definitely wouldn't be able to do that.
Was it important to make those innovations and almost completely rebrand the show because you weren't Keys and Gray?
Yeah, a little bit. I think we did that naturally because, you know, I didn't know Richard or Andy at all, to be honest with you, which sort of helped me because I was sort of determined to be my own person. A bit like when I used to do Jeff Stelling's show in the week. There's no point trying to be like Jeff. Jeff is just sensational. I had to be my own person doing those midweek shows. And I always say to Jeff, you know, I'm responsible for showing just how good he is, because I don't think I was very good at it, but I enjoyed it. But then, and it's the case now. Even more now, however many years later, on ITV, we've got to innovate all the time. You can't stand still. The old mantra that Nev used to tell me with Sir Alex Ferguson at Man United, if you stand still, you'll fall off the pace. Whenever they won the league, you'll look back at it, they always change something. Often behind the scenes, Sir Alex would change something with his staff, often the high-profile players, obviously, as well. But they never stood still. When Monday Night Football, finally I had a show that succeeded. When I first started at Sky, I did Sky Sports Centre, died. I did 90 Minutes. Kirsty Gallagher left, died. I did the full SP with Jeff Stelling, died. So finally I had a show that was working on Monday Night Football. We just won an RTS, Royal Television Society Award. This for me was like manna from heaven. I was flying. And then Nev said, we need to change it. We need to innovate. Now's the time to change it. Sir Alex would change it now. And lo and behold, we're getting Jamie Carragher. And I was thinking at the time, what are we doing? What are we doing? But it was the right decision.
Ed will be joining us again later for our quick fire quiz. Next, it's all about VAR, or as an aggrieved Charlie Austin put it, VAR, VAR, VAR.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
It wasn't a great weekend for referees, was it? With controversial goals chalked off at Southampton and Liverpool and penalties and red cards not given.
Yeah, I was at the game at St Mary's. I've never seen a more farcical incident. I wasn't in favour of VAR when it was first mooted. Sam would vouch for that. But after seeing it in action at the World Cup, I think Charlie Austin was absolutely right when he said the Premier League is now stuck in the dark ages.
Well, VAR isn't ready and wasn't ready for the start of the season. Not perfectly Premier League ready anyway. Look, they've built the facility, the technology's there, but you wouldn't start the first day of the season, would you, without testing it? I mean, you couldn't start the first day of the Premier League season without testing absolutely every scenario. And if you can't do VAR from day one, then you can't just bring it in week 18, halfway through a campaign, and allow it to affect the outcomes of games because the integrity of the competition is questioned. The trials that we had last year were not universally popular, as you admitted, because you weren't convinced by it, were you?
No, I could see the faults. For me, the big fault with VAR is still that the fans in the stadium don't know what's happening.
Exactly, and sometimes that affects the players as well. You liked it at the World Cup because it was better organised. Trust me, as an advocate of VAR, I like the word trailblazer. I was still getting stick galore in January when Spurs played Rochdale. Danny Rose was kicking off about it after the game because of the delays in the actual fixture, and no one at home or in the ground knew what was going on. Now everyone's like, why isn't there any VAR? The reason is it's not fully ready. The PGMOL have never tested using VAR 10 simultaneous games. It needs a team of 4 trained personnel. They need to make sure they've got all of those. And to do 10 simultaneous games, you need to use all of them at the same time. They haven't worked out how to get the communication with the stadium audience uniformly correct. It's okay at West Ham because you've got those massive, great big screens. There is actually a giant screen at Chelsea. There will be at Tottenham. But Selhurst Park, is there enough communication there? Anfield, there's not even a big screen there. Old Trafford, there's not a big screen either, is there? They still communicate decisions in-game when using VAR on trials, to me, over WhatsApp.
No
serious?
Way.
That is a serious story. There's a designated person in the VAR room who will text me and WhatsApp me what they are checking for, because sometimes you don't necessarily know what it is that they're looking at, which is, you know, you remember the England game, James Tarkowski gave away a penalty in the last minute. No one knew why the penalty was given. Actually, the only people that did know were the broadcasters because they had a direct route to the VAR room. So you need to have that communication. But the only reason I've got that contact is because I was proactive. You know, nobody else gets that. So the other written media and the other radio broadcasters don't have that. The TV boys do because they've got a line to the room. But no one else has. And until you sort that out so everybody's got it, it can't be used. So yes, it is going to be in place next season. Yes, it is the right thing to do. But so has been waiting to get it absolutely spot on right because they weren't comfortable. Separate note, should it have been sorted out 3 years ago? Should it have been something they've been working towards for the last decade in the background? Absolutely, but that's a different debate. It will come in next year.
I just got one question back to the Charlie Austin incident. The fourth official has the ability to communicate with the referee via a headpiece, correct?
Not after watching a monitor. He's not allowed to watch the monitor.
See, that's just backwards, isn't it? Because the reason the goal wasn't given is because they say Maya Yoshida touched the ball. Clearly he didn't. The fourth official would have known that, should have been able to relay that, and we would have avoided the controversy.
He's not allowed to do that.
On a side note, it is ironic that Maya Yoshida has stopped a goal going in because he hasn't done that too much at the other end this season.
Claws. But that's absolutely ludicrous, isn't it? Surely the more thoughts on it from officials, the better to help each other out. Surely.
They are allowed to communicate, they are allowed to collaborate, but they're not allowed to use technology in order to influence their decisions. Otherwise, if they did that, it would damage the integrity of the game because they're at some grounds at the moment which don't use it, and it's not in the rules. So, you know, it's like, actually this season for the first time, you're allowed to use small electronic devices on the bench, but you're not allowed to do it to review incidents and then go and have a go at the referee about it.
Well, I don't think this will be the last time we'll be talking about VAR on the podcast. Remember, you can tweet us or Instagram us on @AFCGeeks. And next, Ed will be back to answer our quick fire questions.
Okay, we just finished a lovely main course, so we are going to take a break before dessert and do our quick fire quiz. Ed is here, 60 seconds to answer as many questions as possible. First of all, what is the one thing that you always carry with you to every broadcast?
A pen with those four colours, a bit like Sam Matterface.
He has about 18 colours. Which of your fellow ITV hosts or Sky pundits keeps or kept you on your toes the most? I can probably guess the answer to this.
Neville, without a shadow of a doubt.
I thought you were going to say Matt Chapman. Cheltenham or Royal Ascot?
I would have said Cheltenham. I now say Royal Ascot, would you believe?
The outfit.
Always Cheltenham. Carragher or Neville?
Francesco Cimani. Neat.
Bell or Cimani?
Oh, crikey. Cimani.
The worst place you've stayed on your broadcast travels?
Oh, that's harsh. Air.
What is the most memorable event you've covered?
Aguero's goal, Sir Alex Ferguson's final day at Old Trafford, and Tiger Roll winning the Grand National.
If you could go back in time and cover any sporting event, what would it be?
Oh, Ali Fraser, Southampton winning the FA Cup. England winning the World Cup even further.
What one change would you make to make your job easier?
I'd like to get more out of the jockeys. I want jockeys, they're the players. I really want to engage with the players.
And a slightly personal one here. If Ronald Koeman wanted to come back to Southampton, would you take him?
A couple of years ago I'd have said no. Right now I'd say yes.
Great stuff. Thanks, Ed.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks or get in touch on Instagram.
I thought Ed Chamber was absolutely brilliant. Thanks very much to him for coming on the programme. We really appreciate it. We'll have another guest geek very shortly.
Well, I know international breaks for you boys mean you get to kick back and relax. I actually am going away this time, but not while there are still games on. I should be at a League One or League Two game this week, just waiting to hear where. I'll be presenting as well over the international break, but I am jetting off a long way to Paris, which is not very far compared to you, Crook. Is it? Where are you going?
I am going on honeymoon. You remember I talked about in an earlier podcast that we delayed the honeymoon until the international break. I'm off to the Maldives in a few hours' time, and I will mainly be avoiding the football, especially that farce that is England against the USA, the Rooney benefit game.
So will you be sitting in a seat and hoping that no one sits next to you on this particular plane?
Well, unfortunately, I think the wife might have to sit next to me. But yeah, ideally, I'd love a whole row to myself.
I tell you what, I don't know if she probably wants to sit next to you, actually, to be honest. Although she's quite small and petite, isn't she? So she'll fit in a little tiny chair. I like the way that you two are going
ridiculous.
Off jet setting. And I'm not kicking back and relaxing, Michelle. I've got Spain-Croatia on Thursday. And I've got Northern Ireland's relegation worries in the Nation League on the Sunday. I've got, in between, two live Brazil games. Brazil coming to the UK. They're playing at the Emirates Stadium on Friday. Tickets still available. They're playing against Uruguay. 8 o'clock kickoff. It's going to be fantastic to see Brazil in this country. And then on Tuesday, they're playing Cameroon at Stadium MK, and I'm doing both those games as well.
I think it's really kind of Brazil, actually, to come over and play a game at the Emirates so the Arsenal fans finally get the chance to see some well-cast players there.
That's a joke I used at a charity event the other night. You've nicked it.
Predictable, boys. Well, we've got someone that's doing absolutely nothing, someone that's doing a bit, and someone that's very, very busy. So you can hear what we got up to on the next episode. We are out of time for another week. Thanks for lending us your ears. Please remember to tell all your friends about the podcast and be sure to join us for the next edition of All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
They don't know how to make small talk, but they do know when Raheem Sterling last scored for England. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.